Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Kalik, and this is Dispatches. Israel was not founded because of the Holocaust, nor is its behavior driven by so-called Holocaust trauma. Rather, the Holocaust has been weaponized to demonize and dehumanize Israel's victims, to immunize the Zionist state from criticism, and to justify its ongoing colonialism and genocide in Gaza. It's through this weaponization of the Holocaust that Israel can portray itself not as the aggressor, but as the eternal victim with a permanent get-out-of-jail-free card. In fact, what truly drives Israel, similar to colonial movements before it, isn't victimhood, but land theft mixed with a fear that its indigenous victims will seek retribution. Joining me to discuss this and more is Tony Greenstein, a longstanding Jewish anti-Zionist, Marxist, and anti-fascist activist from the UK, and author of Zionism During the Holocaust. But before we jump into it, this is just part of this episode. The full interview is available to Breakthrough News members only. You can become a member at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. Tony, welcome to the show.
Yeah, welcome to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. And I'm really excited to talk about the subject matter at hand, which is this excellent piece that she wrote for the Electronic Intifada, which I encourage everyone to go check out. The title is Israel's Holocaust Trauma is a Myth. And you very meticulously go through why that's the case. Before I ask you any questions about that, I want to play this clip that you actually opened the piece with. And this is going to be a clip of Naftali Bennett speaking to Sky News a few months ago and more, you know, closer to the beginning of the genocide in Gaza, where he does reference the Holocaust in a very typical way to kind of justify or actually antagonize the host for daring to ask about Gaza's civilian population. So let's take a listen to that and then we can go from there.
And what about those Palestinians in hospital who are on life support and babies and incubators whose life support and incubator will have to be turned off because the Israelis have cut the power to Gaza?
Are you seriously keep on asking me about Palestinian civilians? What's wrong with you? Have you not seen what happened? We're fighting Nazis. We don't target them. Now, the world can come and bring them anything they want. If you want to bring them electricity, I'm not going to feed electricity or water to my enemies. If anyone else wants, that's fine. We're not responsible for them.
This is the point.
But you
this
keep
is
on.
The point.
You, no, no, I want to tell you. No, listen. You listen
no, you're
to me right
your
now.
Voice,
I've heard
trying,
you enough.
No, I understand. We're trying to have a conversation here. Listen, this is my program. This is my show. And I am asking the questions.
Exactly.
You're raising your voice, and I've asked you, and we've already.
So that's about enough of that. I can't listen to Naftali Bennett whine much longer. But I mean, that's pretty emblematic of the sort of attitude that you get from Israeli government officials, and often, you know, always have, but really in a more extreme way. And so, you know, you wrote in this piece that I referenced for the Electronic Intifada, the lazy explanation for Israel's genocidal and exterminationist mentality is Holocaust trauma. Using the Holocaust as a catch-all explanation is convenient because it absolves people of the need to look for the real cause of Israeli Zionist violence. So go ahead and explain to us, you know, based on what I just set up, based on Naftali Bennett's comments, why is this Holocaust trauma that Israel often references to justify its atrocity such a myth?
Well, the Zionist movement has used the Holocaust almost since its inception. There is nothing new in what Naftali Bennett said. I mean, he is a Judeo-Nazi, a Jewish Nazi. I mean, let's face it, there's no difference really between what Hans Frank, the Governor General, the Nazi Governor General of Poland, said when he talked about death by hunger. And 83,000 people, Jews, died in the Warsaw Ghetto from hunger, not from deportation to Treblinka. There's nothing new at all. When the Holocaust survivors were forced to go to Palestine and then Israel after 1945, and they were wanted primarily as cannon fodder for the so-called War of Independence, there is nothing new in this at all. When the Holocaust survivors were forced to go to Palestine after 1945, And you may not know, but in the displaced persons camps of Europe, Haganah was active in suppressing Jewish anti-Zionists, the Bund supporters, those who survived the Holocaust, and so on. They were told when they got to Israel, when they were fighting, conscripted into the Israeli Defense Force or the Zionist terror militias, Haganah, Egon, Lehi, they were told by David Ben-Gurion in the fledgling army that they were fighting the neo Nazis. That was in 1947, 1948. So there is really nothing new about this. And the worst, those who committed the worst atrocities, those who were the fiercest in their hatred of the indigenous Palestinians, were the Holocaust survivors, because in their eyes, the Palestinians were attacking them because they were Jewish. That was the theme. That's always been the theme. Of course, we know that's not true. But, you know, when you're brought from Europe and you've been living in a displaced persons camp, you know nothing of the history, you know nothing of the background, so you would be very susceptible to that message. So fast forward 75 years, and why would the Palestinians break out of Gaza? It wouldn't have anything to do with the siege, still less to do with the occupation. After all, Israel treats them wonderfully. So it could only be because they hate Israelis because they're Jews, and they come to them as Jews, and they call them Yahud because that's how they know them. So the Holocaust as a narrative has always been present in Zionism, whether it's Labour Zionism or revisionist Zionism, whether it's, if you like, Herzog from the Labour Zionist tradition, or Naftali Bennett from the far right of the Zionist movement. The theme has always been the same. Of course, this is hypocritical, because after the Holocaust in Israel, they really did not want to know very much about the Holocaust, because they were building a new Jew. They were building a new country. And the Holocaust survivors reminded them of the old accursed Galut diaspora. And you know, if you listen to some of what they say about the diaspora Jews, if you didn't know who was talking, you would think it was a convinced neo-Nazi. I mean, if I can plug my book, which I've just written very recently, it's on Zionism during the Holocaust. And it gives many, many examples of this. Joachim Doron, who's a political scientist historian in Israel, wrote an article for the Journal of Israeli History, which is, I think, the main journal of the Zionist movement, Classic Zionism and Its Enemies. And he said if you didn't know, say, who was talking, it would be the anti-Semites. And he said it must sound strange to people brought up in the Auschwitz generation to hear what the Zionists were saying about Jews, because it really was no different from what their enemies were saying. There was nothing at all different from what Ben-Gurion was saying in 1948 to what Naftali Bennett was saying in 2024. The message was the same. You hate us, not because we've come and stolen your land and driven you off it, but because we're Jewish. It's as if the white South Africans have been saying to those living under apartheid, you're not fighting us because of the system of apartheid, land dispossession, and so on, but simply because we're white. And for many of them, that was the case. So, I mean, this is the reaction of the traditional settler colonial. But in Israel at the time, as I said, they really didn't want to know about the Holocaust. I mean, Holocaust survivors were called sabon, soap. They were treated with contempt. Hansi Brand, who was the wife of Rudolf Kastner, a very famous collaborator, said that they simply didn't want to know. When I talked about our war, they talked about their war. They treated them, I won't say with hostility, but with a visible irritation They didn't want to know about what had occurred in the diaspora. Israel was a new startup nation. It was a breaking free of the accursed Galut, the diaspora. Because as Ben-Gurion said, there's been a gap of 2,000 years in the history of the Jewish people. And it's only now been resumed with the birth of the Israeli state. So that was always the case. So when October the 7th happened, it was a terrible shock. I have absolutely no doubt about it. But it was a shock that all settler colonials experience when those they've been oppressing for so long rise up against them. I mean, that was the case in the slave plantations in the Caribbean. It was true in America, in the United States. You had the Nat Turner Rebellion. You had other rebellions. They were put down with savagery. You had the Governor Eyre controversy in Jamaica in the 1870s when there was a vicious counter-reaction by the governor and the planters there. It had nothing to do with their opponents being white. It had everything to do with the role that they played. So in Haiti, for example, Santo Domingo, with a successful slave uprising in, I think it was 1791, the black population slaughtered every single white French person. I mean, they were quite savage. I mean, far, far worse than anything that occurred on October the 7th. Though, incidentally, the German whites were spared. So it simply wasn't because they were white. It was because of where they came from and what they were doing. And I have no doubt on October the 7th, there were some atrocities. In every war, you get that. But it really, of course, is nothing compared to the savagery of Israel today. I mean, you can't compare it. So, I mean, there was no Holocaust trauma. I mean, in Israel, in the first syllabus, school syllabus, history school syllabus, which was about 200 pages long, had, I think, 12 pages on the Napoleonic Wars. It had one on the Holocaust. So at that time, the Holocaust was something that was in the distant past. It was
So that's actually what I want to get you to elaborate on that for a moment in terms of the Holocaust in Israeli life, because what you're alluding to is what you talk about in your piece as well, as you raise this point that, in fact, the Holocaust didn't play a major role in Israeli life until 1953, when it was first mentioned in the school syllabus. And I'm going to quote from your piece. It says, despite exploiting the Holocaust survivors, Israelis had contempt for them as sheep who had gone to the slaughter. Unlike them, the, quote, new Jews in Palestine, who are waging war against the indigenous population. And then you note it's been documented that the survivors were popularly called this Hebrew word for soap, due to a belief that the Nazis had used them, their human fat, to make soap during the war. And then there's this prevailing view among settlers in Palestine was that Holocaust survivors represented, quote, the survival of the worst in the eyes of David Ben-Gurion. They were hard, evil, and selfish people, and their experiences destroyed what good qualities they have left. So I guess to that, I want to ask you if you can maybe explain to our audience this very antagonistic view towards Holocaust survivals inside the state of Israel, and when the Holocaust even started to be weaponized in the ways that, you know, we see it being weaponized now, because it clearly didn't happen. I mean, you mentioned it happened in refugee camps to get people to go fight in 1948 against the indigenous population in Palestine to formulate the state of Israel. But then after that, it's kind of ignored until it's brought back in. And then there's the pretty horrible treatment of actual Holocaust survivors inside the state of Israel, to the point where the Israeli government was even taking reparations meant for them and putting it in their own coffers. So I know I just mentioned a lot for you to unpack there, but yeah, if you could maybe talk about the role of the Holocaust in the state of Israel, kind of from its birth to now, and what that's meant for actual Holocaust survivors.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you like, most people believe that Israel was set up as a refuge for Jews from anti-Semitism. I mean, that's a common popular myth, and it's something that's believed by Jews worldwide. But it's simply not true. Israel, if you like, the Zionist project's main aim was the creation of, it was like, if you like, a racial preservation project. And the only way you could achieve that was via statehood. I mean, that was what it was about, in essence. And Ben-Gurion was absolutely clear when he made his famous statement that if I knew I could save all of the German Jewish children, this was the Kinder transport in 1938-39, if I could save all the German Jewish children, because Britain had agreed to admit 10,000 by going to England, and only half of them by going to Palestine, I would choose the latter course, because I have to look to the people of history, not simply the lives of those children. And even in the early 1920s, when thousands of Ukrainian Jews wanted to escape to Palestine to get away from the pogroms, Weizmann was adamant that they couldn't come in. They were the wrong sort of Jews. They were precisely the detritus of the diaspora, and they didn't want them. And they always had this policy of selectivity, and it continued throughout the war. And it was real resentment, if you read what the Zionist leaders were saying, that refugees were coming in who had nothing to offer. So, I mean, this idea was a myth. And in my book, I detail the Argentinian junta in between 1976-83. I don't know whether you're aware of what happened, but it's a story in itself. The first, probably the only neo-Nazi regime to come to power in the post-war period was in Argentina. And they had their own conspiracy theory, the Andina conspiracy, instead of the normal elders of Zion. It was Marx, Freud, and Einstein who were the trio who were trying to create a Jewish state in Patagonia. And up to 12.5% of the 30,000 Argentinians who died under torture were Jewish, even though Argentinian Jews constitute less than 1% of the population. And did Israel want to know? The Knesset wouldn't even discuss the matter throughout the whole period of the junta, because it was arming them. It was giving them weapons. And Argentina was the biggest single purchaser of Israeli weapons. And Israel was a fundamental part of the anti-communist alliance, which Argentina was a part of under Reagan. So this idea that Israel was a refuge, when the Israeli embassy was turning away applications for visas for people whose lives were in danger. And to this day, I mean, there's a silence over Israel's role there. So I think we need to debunk this idea that Israel is a Jewish state in anything other than the racial form. It's a state of Jewish supremacy, but it's not a state that serves or has any meaning for Jews living in the diaspora. And that's kind of the myth that's grown up. But throughout history, Zionism and anti-Semitism were kind of twins of a kind. They couldn't survive without each other. And that was reflected in the attitudes to the Holocaust. I mean, today, I mean, you have rabbis like Rabbi Cash Tiel saying, well, Hitler was right, he just got the wrong target. It should have been the Palestinians, although I don't think there were many Palestinians in Nazi Germany at any time. But, I mean, that is their attitude. They have no basic objection to the Nazi program. I mean, that is the irony of Zionism, which claims to be the solution to anti-Semitism. So the Holocaust really did not figure. I mean, it was the myth of Masada, where the few hundred Jewish zealots allegedly committed suicide rather than surrender to the Romans in the Judean fortress of Masada. That was the main myth that the Israeli state fostered right up till really the Eichmann trial in 1961. And it was then, the opening speech of Gideon Hausner, the prosecutor, was when he spoke about Jews in Europe having gone like sheep to the slaughter. That was their attitude. And really, even that attitude continues today. Israel commemorates the Holocaust on, I think, 3 days a year, national holidays, speeches, and so on, parades. But that is different from the actual Holocaust survivors who still continue to live in Israel. They live in poverty, many of them, over a third. They choose between food and eating and heating. Their reparations, Ben-Gurion was insistent, should go to the Jewish state, not to them individually. It would be the Jewish state that carved them out. There were different arrangements in other countries when it was handled by the Jewish Claims Conference, but that's another story anyway, because the corruption in that organization, where just millions of dollars were simply embezzled by people like Rabbi Israel Singer, for example. I mean, quite a number were sent to prison in these scandals. But the Holocaust survivors have been seen as an expendable commodity. Very, very useful, of course, for propagating Israel's image as the answer to age-old anti-Semitism. And the Eichmann trial itself, I say, was held in 61 after Eichmann was kidnapped in Argentina. But really, the only reason it was held was because of the lingering scandal and stain of the Kastner trial. Now, I don't know whether you're aware of that in the 1950s or not.
No, please, feel free to elaborate on that.
Okay, well, I mean, very... I'll try and be as brief as I can. In essence, what happened on April the 10th, 1944, Rudolf Werber and Alfred Wetzler, two Jewish people who were working in Canada, the place in Auschwitz where they sorted the belongings of those who'd been exterminated. They escaped from Auschwitz. It was a perilous escape. They were apart from one other Jew, Lederer, who was taken out of Auschwitz by a friendly SS officer. They were the first real, genuine Jewish escapees. And it was extremely perilous, but thanks to the Auschwitz resistance and Russian prisoners of war who had experience, they got out. And then there was a two-week trek to Slovakia. And when they were there, they met the Jewish council, the Judenrat, there. And they set down on paper in separate rooms their account of what happened at Auschwitz and what was happening. And the reason they escaped was because they were building a new ramp in Birkenau so that the trains went right up to the gas chambers rather than having to walk 2 or 3 kilometers, which delayed the process. So they were making the gassing of Jews more efficient. And the reason why was Hungary was the last major Jewish community to survive in Europe. And the Nazis had occupied it on March 19th, 1944, because they feared that the Hungarians were going to switch sides in the war, because obviously the war was going badly for Nazi Germany. And what was produced was the Werber-Wetzler report when they sat down, or sometimes it's known as the Auschwitz Protocols when it incorporates other documents as well. For the first time ever, concrete proof existed of the existence of Auschwitz as an extermination camp. Prior to that, the belief was that Auschwitz was a major labor camp because it had large numbers of industries, IG Farben, Siemens, and so on. It had about 40 outlets. There were factories in what was called Auschwitz III, where slave labor was used. So it was very, very profitable. That was what Auschwitz was thought to be. I mean, in my book, I go through the fact that Auschwitz was not discovered as an extermination camp because the Allies really did not want to know. But anyway, the fact is that Werber and Wetzler escaped from Auschwitz. They compiled this document, and it was sent abroad to the Vatican and to many other people. It was also given to the personal representative of Hungarian Zionism, Rudolf Kastner, who was the chair or the vice chair of the Zionist Relief and Rescue Committee. And he sat on it. What he did was negotiate an agreement with Eichmann that the Zionist and Jewish elites would leave Hungary on a train, which they did on the 1st of July, 1944. So I think it was 1,684 people. Eventually, they went first to Bergen-Belsen concentration camp, and then they went on in two stages to Switzerland. So they escaped. But the deal, in essence, was that Eichmann, was that Kastner, would keep quiet about the destination of the deportation trains. Not only that, Kastner was active in misinforming the Jews that where they were going was a fictitious resettlement place called Kenya Maze. And he was instrumental in distributing postcards from another place, Waldsee, from the people who had arrived from the deportation trains in Auschwitz, saying everything was fine, look forward to seeing you, etc. These postcards were, if you like, written or signed by the Jewish deportees when they arrived in Auschwitz. And in fact, when people read them, they managed to see through them because people who arrived were able to give details of things like your auntie is looking forward to seeing you, even though their auntie had died 10 years ago. So they twigged that something was not right.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, Kastner was instrumental in pacifying the Hungarian Jews who were destined for deportation. And nearly half a million, 437,000 were deported to Auschwitz. And I imagine about 350,000 of them died. I think 80,000 were taken on to labor in Germany itself. But when the Holocaust, those who survived Auschwitz itself came back and came to Israel, they had Kastner in their sights. Why did you misinform us? Why did you lie to us? Why did you tell us that we should get on the trains first to get the best accommodation in a place that didn't exist? And this scandal blew up into the Kastner trial in Israel. It started in 1954. In fact, the allegation had been made that Kastner was a collaborator by this Hungarian Jew called Malchiel Greenwald. And the state had insisted that Kastner bury this by suing him for libel. And that's what happened, except it went wrong. Because one of the first questions that was asked is, did you give testimony at Nuremberg to save a Nazi war criminal, Himmler's personal emissary in Hungary, Kurt Becher? And Kastner angrily denied it. And then Shmuel Tamir, who later became a minister under Menachem Begin, produced the affidavit in court. And he was shown to be a liar. And from then it was downhill in the trial. And the judge, 1955, Benjamin Halevi of the Jerusalem District Court, found in his words, the famous words, that he'd sold his soul to Satan. And that was, in essence, Zionism. And because the government were determined to appeal, the government fell. The second Israeli government under Moshe Sharet fell because of that verdict. So it had huge repercussions in Israel itself. Although Kastner was eventually acquitted by the Supreme Court, it was clearly on political grounds. They found that the facts, as found by the Jerusalem District Court, were true. They also found that in the case of Kurt Becher, that he had collaborated. And it was a 4-1, or some people say 3-2 verdict, as one judge, Goyton, was incredibly ambivalent about whether, in fact, he should acquit. So it was a very mixed verdict. But I say the impact of the Kastner trial percolated through. And this is what led, in essence, to the Eichmann trial. And they took extreme precautions at the Eichmann trial to ensure that the Kastner affair was not raised in any sense, shape, or form. So, for instance, the last commander of the Warsaw Ghetto Resistance, Marek Edelman, was not invited. Neither was Rudolf Werber. Apparently, Israel could not afford their airfare from Western Europe or Poland in Marek Edelman's case. So, I mean, this is the reality of the Zionist record during the Holocaust. But I go into it in depth in my book.
Tony, I'm glad that we could do a part two here because we had some tech issues before. We'll try to work around this time. Let's just jump right into it here for part two. And I wanted to prod you a bit more on a point that you were making. You were talking about how, you know, the anti-fascists in Europe took the lessons of the Holocaust and universalized them, right? Whereas yeah. when it comes to the issues around Israel and Zionism, it's quite the opposite. So I wanted to use that as like a segue to ask you about a term that we've been hearing more and more about recently as people kind of get hungrier to understand the situation with Palestine. And that's the idea of the Holocaust industry. So can you explain to our audience, what do we mean when we talk about the so-called Holocaust industry? And what does that have to do with Palestine?
Oh, well, it has everything to do with Palestine. Well, it's quite simple. The Israel, well, the Zionist movement, having done absolutely nothing to try and prevent or to try and save or to rescue Jewish refugees from the Holocaust while it was happening. And today you wouldn't believe, I mean, everything the Zionists mention has something to do with the Holocaust. During the Holocaust itself, they really didn't want to know about the Holocaust. In fact, I mean, I think of Boaz Evron's book, Jewish State or Israeli Nation. And he quotes from the Zionist executive minutes that Ben-Gurion, Tabenkin, Weizmann, and all the others, notables on the Zionist executive, were complaining that people, by focusing on the Jewish refugees, were distracting attention and taking away the fundraising from the need to build the Jewish state, which is the priority, as far as they were concerned. The Holocaust was entirely secondary. Indeed, even after they announced, because they'd been forced to, because the evidence had accumulated such that the Holocaust was happening, that was in November 1942, even though they'd known about it for 4 or 5 months. Even after then, they then issued a statement under the name of Yitzhak Greenberg, who was the chair of the Zionist or the Jewish Agency Rescue Committee, that the Holocaust had come to an end, that there were 55 Polish ghettos in Poland and that at least 2 million Jews had survived. Where did they get this from? Ostland, a Nazi paper. So they were quoting evidence from the Nazis to prove that there was no Holocaust, for which even the PALCOR, the Jewish agency, press agency, protested. So it would seem, and there's a really good book by this right-wing Zionist, Shabtai Betzvi. It's entitled The Ugandan, on the question of the Ugandan situation. He compared it to Uganda, the project under Herzl. Even he said, I mean, they were amazed that they simply didn't want to recognize what was happening. And the reason was because it was really a distraction. I mean, if you're a Zionist and you're a good Zionist and you're a leader, then you were focused entirely on building a Jewish state. And really, everything else was beside the matter. It was just secondary at best. And you really did not want to distract and take away from people's efforts. Unless you could tie the refugee question to the Zionist question. That was the only exception. Because the refugees, the Jews who wanted to escape from Europe, if you could divert them solely in terms of entering Palestine and use them to break down the barriers to immigration, then that was acceptable. But if it was separated, and Ben-Gurion in a famous letter in December 1938, and if you want, I can quote to you if you're happy.
Yeah, feel free.
Yeah, because it will illustrate my point. Let me just, I'm just quoting from my book now. I mean, because I've got all these quotations here. It was He wrote in a memorandum, in fact, to the Zionist executive of the 17th of December, 1938. Bear in mind, this is just a month after Kristallnacht, the Nazi pogrom against the Jews. And he said, if the Jews are faced with a choice between the refugee problem and rescuing Jews from concentration camps on the one hand, and aid for the National Museum in Palestine on the other, the Jewish sense of pity will prevail, and our people's entire strength will be directed to aid for the refugees in the various countries. Zionism will vanish from the agenda, and indeed not only world public opinion in England and America, but also from Jewish public opinion. We are risking Zionism's very existence if we allow the refugee problem to be separated from the Palestine problem. So that's why when they talk about the refusal of the West to admit refugees, they simply do that in terms of Palestine. They don't complain that Britain wouldn't allow them into Britain or America into America. Their only complaint is they weren't allowed to come as settlers to Palestine. And that was a Zionist theme throughout. And there's a very famous quote. I don't know whether you've heard it, but I'm sure your viewers will be interested. Because after 1938, Kristallnacht, the world was inflamed, the opinion. And the British made an exception to what was a strict immigration policy. And they agreed to what was called the Kinder Transport, whereby 10,000 Jewish children would be admitted to England from Nazi Germany. That included the conquest in Czechoslovakia. And Ben-Gurion said this. I mean, Ben-Gurion, if you like, laid down the parameters of the policy, but he wasn't in a minority. There was no dissent from what he said. And he said, because they were campaigning that these children should be admitted to Palestine, not to England. And he said, if I knew that it would be possible to save all the children in Germany by bringing them over to England, and only half of them by transporting them to Eretz Yisrael, that is the land of Israel, then I would opt for the second alternative. For we must weigh not only the life of these children, but also the history of the people of Israel. I mean, and that's in his own official biography. It's in many other documents. No one disputes that quote at all. And indeed, if you really want to know about Ben-Gurion's attitude throughout the Holocaust, you could do worse than read Shabtai Tabeth's hagiography, really, of Ben-Gurion. The very final chapter, which is entitled Disaster Means Strength. And what that meant was that the greater the disaster to the Jewish people, the stronger the Zionist movement. Because without the disaster, there would have been maybe no Israel, because they wouldn't have had those refugees. And they were utterly and totally cynical about that. I could give you another quote. And this is from his biographer, who's a good Zionist, Shabtai Tabeth. And he said, and this is on page 851 of The Burning Ground, which says the official biography of Ben-Gurion. He said, if there was a line in Ben-Gurion's mind between the beneficial disaster and an all-destroying catastrophe, it must have been a very fine one. The beneficial disaster, of course, was the Holocaust.
Wow. So it's such an interesting way to look at it, in the sense of, okay, on the one hand, Israel's like, oh yeah, we suffer from Holocaust trauma. That's what drives everything we do. But in reality, it's like they need the Holocaust trauma to exist. But there's another part of this I'm curious if you could talk about. And that is the way that this Holocaust industry is then used to transfer guilt and responsibility for the Holocaust onto Palestinians to make it okay to essentially steal from them and destroy them. And you even mention in the piece you wrote for the Electronic Intifada, you mention how at Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Museum in Israel, how it's devoted an entire wall to the Grand Mufti, who, by the way, let me remind people, at one point Netanyahu a few years ago even tried to accuse the Grand Mufti of actually giving Hitler the idea for the Holocaust. Like, the guy literally tried to blame Palestinians for the Holocaust. But I guess, can you talk about that element of this Holocaust industry, the way it's used on the one hand to basically absolve Europeans, absolve Germans of the responsibility for their actual committal of this heinous act, and then transfer it onto the victims of colonialism in Palestine?
Well, yes. I mean, that's one of the reasons why Germany is so keen on supporting Israel, because it does shift the blame to, if you like, the victims of the victims, except, of course, most Israelis weren't victims in the first place. But the Holocaust industry is, if you like, the whole propaganda industry and everything that's built around it, the Holocaust memorials, the museums, the educational trusts and so on. You see that in this country, in the United States, all of it geared to one message, which is Israel is the answer to the Holocaust. And of course, it isn't any answer at all. And what they do, of course, is they completely decontextualize the Holocaust itself and what caused it and the anti-Semitism. Because anti-Semitism for Zionists is not society. It's not where you live. It's not the scapegoating. It's not the racism against Jews and so on. It was simply the fact that, A, people like you are inherently anti-Semitic because you're not Jewish. You can't help it. It's in your DNA. And having inherited it, as Pinsker said, for 2,000 years, it's an incurable disease. So they call it a virus because it's a virus is something you can't, or generally can't combat, certainly not at that time. But B, that the other cause of it is that Jews are living outside their national home. I mean, it's a kind of blood and soil thing, the belief that every people has an attachment to the land through their own blood and soil and so on. And that Jews had lost that. They were, in the words of A.B. Yehoshua, a famous Zionist novelist who's just died, they were guests in other people's countries. They stayed, they used their those countries like people use hotels, and they'd outstayed their welcome. And so Jacob Klatskin, who was a Zionist theoretician, he edited, developed the Zionist magazine, he said, instead of defending our rights against the anti-Semites who want to take away our rights, we should defend ourselves against those who oppose anti-Semitism, because they are denying us, if you like, our right to live in Palestine. Yeah, so they were opposed to the anti-fascists, and that's why, I mean, in the period before Hitler came to power, the Zionists took no part at all in any anti-fascist activity, and they didn't in Britain. Zionism has never fought anti-Semitism because how can you? It's futile, as Herzl said. You can't eradicate it. If it's in your blood, what can we do? I mean, that was the Zionist message. And that's why Zionism was considered by Jewish socialists and revolutionaries as a totally reactionary ideology. And in Poland, I mean, I don't know whether you know, but in the last three elections in 1938, I think it was May 1938, in Warsaw, for example, there were Jews elected separate members to the councils because they were a national minority. Out of the 20 council seats up for election, the Bund, which was an anti-Zionist Jewish social democratic party, won 17. The Zionists won one. And that was repeated throughout Poland. In other words, Polish Jews, amongst whom Zionism had a base in the 20s, had simply abandoned Zionism because it was seen as legitimizing everything the anti-Semites said. The anti-Semites said, you don't belong, and the Zionists said, yes, we agree. So, but the Holocaust industry, of course, doesn't mention that. It's there to guilt trip people, to weaponize it, not to draw universal lessons, but to draw one particular lesson, which is that the only answer to anti-Semitism, to the Holocaust and so on, is Jews leaving the countries they live in and settling in Palestine, which is why, say, after Pittsburgh, or after, say, the Charlie Hebdo killings, and there was four Jews were murdered in the hypercache supermarket in France. Netanyahu came to Paris and told the French Jews in a speech in the synagogue, your real home is not in France, it's in Israel. And they immediately burst out singing the Marseillaise.
right. I remember that. I remember that. And it's so, I mean, the irony, of course, is it's like taking essentially the Nazi view of what makes a Jew, which is this idea of this racial, I mean, it is Jews have been obviously racialized across Europe, especially. But it's taking that idea and going with it. It's going with it. And it's also like erasing an entire diverse cultural history, because obviously, like, Jewish culture in Germany is not the same as Jewish culture in Morocco in Iraq or in Latin America. But it's taking all this entirely like racially diverse religious group and essentially projecting European Jewish history onto everyone in a way that, you know, just not only erases history, but changes the entire dynamics of entire regions in the global South. But that's, of course, a different story here that I hope to cover on a different episode. But, you know, I want to actually ask you a personal question. I thought it was quite interesting when I was reading some of your bio that you, in fact, are the son of an Orthodox Jewish rabbi. And when you were young, you were a member of a religious Zionist group that you describe as now an integral part of the Messianic settler movement. I'm curious, like, you know, how did you end up shifting from growing up in that environment to having the views that you do now, which are like diametrically opposed to all of that? If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear the rest, you can access it by becoming a Breakthrough News member at patreon.com/breakthroughnews.